All right, everybody, welcome this afternoon to ITRC's training webinar. It's 12:59. The recording has started, so I'm just going to get started with some housekeeping rules for today. So this training is being recorded, and it will be offered on demand for those not able to join us live. The Clumen training page that brought you here today offers the slides for your own viewing. Under download training materials, it also offers background on our trainers as well as a feedback form for the end of the webinar. You can use the Q&A pod at the bottom of your screen to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems at any time during today's training. We will have two question and answer breaks, the first halfway through with the last at the end of the training modules today. For those interested in receiving certificates of completion, they are available upon the completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the feedback form, you'll just check a box to certify that you participated in today's online webinar, and then a certificate of completion will be sent to you. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, we would like to welcome you to today's training, ITRC's Pump and Treat Optimization, which is based on our performance-based optimization of pump and treat systems teams online resources. My name is Devin Suchkar, I'm your moderator today. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses, such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be part of ITRC, we encourage you to visit our website, where you can find out more about the teams that we have available for registration and how you can become an active member. The full ITR disclaimer is also available on our website. If you plan to use any ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the material nor endorse any specific products. On slide five, I have the pleasure of introducing our expert trainers today. All of them have served as members of the Pump and Treat team over the course of the years and volunteered to create this training that we are proud to present today. So with that, you can find all of their bios on the Clumen training page as well, and it has a little bit more background on their expertise as well as the emails in case anyone would like to reach out to any of our trainers. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Michael Sexton from the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality.
All right. Thank you, Devin. I wanted to sort of get oriented this afternoon for the training course and topics. We're going to start out with a quick poll question. It's a two-part question. First, just to sort of gauge your experience and knowledge of optimization and involvement in optimization systems. So if you don't mind there with letting us know how many pump and treat systems you've been involved with. None, 1 to 10, 11 to 25, 26 to 50. And of those, roughly what percentage have been optimized during time working with those? So we'll give you just a few minutes to vote on that. Right. So we're going to close out the poll here. It looks like we've got quite a bit of response in, and like we expected, that we've got some diversity of experience and things with pump and treat. And really, when we look at it, the majority have not been optimized. We've got 18% of our respondents with 1 to 10% range of their projects being optimized. However, we do have a few there that have roughly the upper percentage, the 26 to 50, and we even have a few there with more than 50%. So we've got a diversity of experience. And that's good for today. Hopefully everyone will gain some additional knowledge as part of the training today. But let's get oriented to the training course and topics for today. Okay, the audience. This training is primarily for project managers, operation managers, risk managers, and site investigators. Generally, anyone involved with designing, building, or operating pump and treat systems can benefit. Regulatory agency managers and stakeholders will also find it beneficial in providing a better understanding of pump and treat system optimization processes and principles. Our assumptions for this course is while optimization may occur in any phase of remediation, this training assumes that you have an operating pump and treat system in place to evaluate and optimize. Acknowledgement, the team does acknowledge that optimization of pump and treat may not achieve all site goals. Section 4 and 5 of our document provide support for transition or termination when optimization indicates that pump and treat may not be the solution or the sole solution going forward. Pump and treat optimization goals. The goals are to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of the remedy, maintain or improve receptor protection, ensure adequate maintenance, reduce cost and liability, reduce environmental footprint, and make the remedy more resilient to environmental change. This training in our guidance document presents processes, tools, and resources to assist you in achieving these goals. Let's quickly summarize our key learning objectives for this training. Optimization can and should occur throughout the life cycle of the pump and treat system. We're going to present a systematic process for performance evaluation, process optimization, and system transition. Pump and treat optimization can be beneficial to all parties involved in the cleanup. Optimization can lead to faster, more efficient, timely, and effective cleanup with improved environmental protection and less resource consumption, as well as a more sustainable and resilient remediation. These results are beneficial for the environment, the public, stakeholders, the regulators, and the companies involved. Recommendations to optimize a pump and treat system are based on iterative performance evaluation. As the system is optimized, additional data will be generated and evaluated, and recommendations made as to whether further optimization is necessary. Ultimately, pump and treat systems will either meet the remediation objectives or will need to transition or terminate. Optimization will improve an existing pump and treat system, but it can't fix everything. The performance evaluation may demonstrate that the system cannot achieve the objectives alone or possibly at all. The decision may be to pair the pump and treat system with another remedy or even replace it entirely. Optimization is not performed in a vacuum. There are numerous parties involved, such as stakeholders, regulators, the regulated entities. All of those need to be involved in the optimization decision and implementation. The regulatory framework and sustainable resilient remediation options also need to be considered. Today's training is broken up into four main sections: lifecycle optimization, performance evaluation, process optimization, and transition and termination. Each of those pair with a section of our document, as you'll see there on the screen. During the training, we're going to use a case study, Baytown, to show the optimization process in practice. The Baytown Township is a Superfund site in Lake Elmo, Minnesota. Additional case studies are found in our document in Appendix B. The pump and treat system, or the pump and treat optimization navigational diagram shown on the screen, is designed to serve as a roadmap for this training, as well as the pump and treat optimization document itself. We'll also integrate regulatory, stakeholder, and sustainability and resiliency considerations throughout the training. The guidance document includes individual sections on each of these topics as well. During the presentation, you will see the following icons to highlight our integration of stakeholder and regulatory considerations, as well as SRR. With that, I'll now turn the presentation over to Luke Heldrich for the next section of the training.
Great. Thank you, Michael. This section two provides a framework for conducting optimization throughout the life cycle of a groundwater pump and treat system. And one key assumption around this document is that we're focusing on the life cycle beginning after the pump and treat system has already been designed, built, and has been operating for quite some time. And it's important to note that remedy optimization is an important component of a life cycle approach for identifying and implementing optimization practices in an adaptive manner. The key section objectives are that we're going to identify when opportunities for conducting optimization can occur during the life cycle of groundwater pump and treat operations. And these opportunities typically can be identified based on performance evaluations, which we'll discuss. The second objective is we want to be able to understand how optimization reviews can result in substantial cost avoidance and savings and reduce time to completion for site remedies. The third section objective is that we'd like to identify the opportunities to increase the ability to influence remediation costs. And these opportunities can occur throughout the life cycle of the operation of the pump and treat system. And the final objective for this section is that we'd like to be able to evaluate how performance-based pump and treat optimization can be used to maintain the effectiveness and efficiency of the remedy. So we know that pump and treat systems have been selected as components of remedies for various types of contaminated sites. Think Superfund, RCRA, state programs over the last several decades. But before we delve into the framework, let's review the basic components of a pump and treat system. The first component is around aquifer interception, and this refers to a network of wells or trenches for groundwater extraction using pumps. And these are placed to properly intercept the contaminant plume, provide hydraulic control, prevent off-site migration, and/or reduce the source of mass through removal. The second major component is the conveyance system. And this consists of a mechanical hydraulic infrastructure, including piping, which conveys groundwater from those extraction locations to the above-ground treatment system. The third major component is around contaminant control, reduction or destruction. And this refers to the above ground ex situ treatment processes for treatment of extracted groundwater and also for systems for sludge generation and management. The fourth major component is the discharge system for the extracted groundwater. And here we're referring to the disposal system for treated water, and that might take the form of another well network for reinjection to the subsurface, surface water discharge, or discharge to a POTW or publicly owned treatment works. The fifth major component is the energy and operation of the system, and this refers to the power supply and the controls. And the final major component, number six, is the monitoring system, and this monitoring program includes monitoring the performance of the above ground treatment system and the in situ treatment system of extraction and monitoring wells. And this in situ system of monitoring network can also include a series of meters and sensors and also some controls in the above ground treatment system and wells. So this is the first poll question for this section, and the purpose of this is to test your knowledge before we present additional material. When in the pump and treat life cycle should we consider optimization? During pump and treat selection and design, during implementation of the system, during evaluation that the system is functioning as designed, during normal operation and maintenance, or at site completion, or all the above? Great. Okay. So this is great. 76% answered all of the above, and that's really the answer that we were seeking. The framework for conducting optimization during the life cycle of a groundwater pump and treat system really begins with the initial site assessment through design, implementation, operation and maintenance, and then remedy transition or site completion. So we're next going to look at the stages of remedy optimization as it applies to the assessment and cleanup process. And for this training, we're going to focus optimization efforts on the later stages of the remedial process. And the last two columns, which are highlighted, remedy implementation post-construction activities. So the first highlighted column is remedy implementation, and that corresponds to the design of the pump and treat system, and associated life cycle activities for this phase include pre-design investigation of sources and plumes, treatability testing, pumping tests, and other activities include design of extraction wells and placement of those wells, design of the monitoring well network, establishment of pumping rates and treatment processes, and then equipment selection. And remedy implementation also corresponds to the installation of the system itself and startup and early operation of that system. And some associated life cycle activities with startup and system operation include installation of these extraction and monitoring wells and the construction of the conveyance piping, and also system startup and shakedown and possibly equipment modification. With post-construction activities, these activities correspond to the ongoing system operation and monitoring, late life cycle operation and transition to system shutdown or monitored natural attenuation or alternative technologies if those are deemed necessary. And associated life cycle activities here include continued assessment of hydraulic capture zones, modification of pumping rates, operation and maintenance of extraction wells and treatment systems, and potentially phase shutdown of extraction wells, including system shutdown evaluations and transition to monitored natural attenuation or other treatment technologies if those are deemed more cost-effective and technically practical. Post-construction activities also correspond to closeout and deconstruction of the pump and treat system. And some associated activities here include abandonment of the extraction wells and conveyance piping and demobilization of the treatment works themselves. So now we're going to go over the role of performance evaluations in optimization. And there's a number of components of performance assessments. And the first one corresponds to the evaluation of the above ground treatment system performance. And this is inclusive of the conveyance piping and equipment, the treatment system, and the discharge processes. And treatment process monitoring refers to the measurement of influent flow rate to the treatment plant, concentrations of treatment plant influent and effluent, and also at intermediate points throughout the treatment processes themselves. And one of the primary criteria of the evaluation at this stage is the verification that discharge standards are being achieved. Second major component in the evaluation is the evaluation of the subsurface performance, including plume capture and containment, and recovery performance for the plumes themselves, and also performance of the extraction and injection well networks. And here we're concerned with the effectiveness of the subsurface remedy and that it depends on the accuracy and completion of the conceptual site model. So we're really requiring at this stage a high degree of performance monitoring to address on-site uncertainties that may significantly impact system performance. And the frequency of monitoring here is really based on the rate of change that we're seeing in the system. So the change in hydraulics, contaminant trends, geochemical changes, and also the proximity to receptors. And these are all important aspects of the conceptual site model. The third major component of performance assessment is the monitoring system itself, which also includes reporting, project management, contracting, and then sustainability considerations. And monitoring of contaminant concentrations and groundwater levels are compared against predicted performance criteria. We also evaluate pumping effectiveness of the extraction wells themselves, and we use this information to help determine if the extraction well network is continuing to provide the most effective and efficient recovery. And this evaluation is most often conducted individually for each well, along with other components of the performance evaluation, and we use this information to indicate if we need adjustments to pumping rates, if we need to clean wells, or rehabilitate wells, or if installation of new extraction wells are needed to maintain or increase the recovery efficiency of the system. And ultimately, the evaluations mentioned here produce data that we use in our optimization assessments. And data really informs how we conduct optimization. Performance assessments conducted at a site can help update the conceptual site model periodically. And they're also used to identify whether the remedy performance is evolving as predicted and whether the remedy is likely to achieve cleanup objectives. The table on this slide presents considerations and data that we typically use for performance-based evaluations. When considering these items, there are specific variables that will help inform next steps. And these are just a few examples. The first one is around conceptual site model update. And here we're considering data and information collected during operations, and we use that to inform further adjustments to the system. This could include new knowledge of preferential flow paths, for example. The second is around changing conditions. And here we're considering data on additional sources, should they become known, additional mass of contaminant, changing concentration distributions. And the third is around controlling contaminant transport. And here we're evaluating aquifer and hydraulic conditions. And one outcome of this is that new pumping locations might be needed to adequately intercept the plume. The fourth is around remedy performance. And here we're evaluating well design and pumping performance. And one outcome here might be that adjustments to pumping conditions may be warranted if sufficient capture or mass removal isn't being attained. Okay, here's our second poll question for this section. And again, this is a knowledge check. And the question here is, how can optimization typically affect cost of remediation efforts over time? Choose all that apply. May decrease the accuracy of the estimates for total long-term costs. It may increase costs due to longer operational time frame. It may decrease costs due to shorter operational time frame, or it may increase monitoring costs over time. All right, great. This is what we were looking for. The majority of the answers are around option C, which was decreasing cost due to shorter operational time frame. And the other options may occur as part of optimization. They may occur during the course of a project, but here we are looking at the word typically. And what we're trying to do is really reduce the effort, if possible, based on the performance of the system. Okay, so now we're looking at the project lifecycle, and there's two parts of this figure. The top part of the figure depicts effort and cost per year versus time for a typical evaluation and cleanup effort at a contaminated site. You'll see that in the initial stages of a site response, much of that effort is focused on characterization, risk assessment, remedy evaluation selection, and source control and remediation. As that project matures, resources are increasingly spent for monitoring and treatment system operation and maintenance, and monitoring can indeed be an extensive cost component and can also proceed for an extended period of time. As indicated by the dashed line, at site closure, technical and remedy performance uncertainties may impact the accuracy of the estimates for long-term costs. The bottom part of the figure is that instead of continuing indefinitely with a long-term O&M, it is possible through optimization to reduce costs as well as time to site completion. And depending on site-specific conditions, optimization reviews can result in substantial cost avoidance and savings and enable reductions in time to achieve site completion. And it's important to note that optimization has a greater ability to influence lifecycle costs if performed early during planning and early system operation. And the highest influence is in the planning stages. And we also note that early incorporation of independent optimization reviews or direct application of lessons learned into the remedy selection, design, and procurement phases of work can also be quite effective. And really, the ability to influence project costs decrease through construction operation, maintenance, and monitoring. All right, here we're just introducing the case study a bit more, and this is going to be discussed throughout the training session. This is the Baytown Township groundwater plume site, and some of the key features here are that trichloroethene, or TCE, was detected in private wells in the late 1980s. The site was added to the NPL in 1994. It's a fairly large plume, 7 square miles, and it's fairly deep at 270 feet deep. And the system is a hydraulic containment system that's been operating since 2008. And some of the key points for the system is that there's a hydraulic barrier that consists of a series of extraction wells along two portions of the perimeter of the site. There's an air stripper that's used to treat trichloroethene impacted groundwater. That treated groundwater is reinfiltrated to the subsurface. And the problem that was being experienced is that there were rebounding and fluctuating TCE levels throughout the plume, and that resulted in an optimization review in 2011. And this case study really illustrates the framework that's presented in this optimization guidance. And during the course of this training, we'll use this site to walk through the steps of evaluation, optimization, and transition or termination. So the key takeaways for this section are that there are opportunities to conduct optimization, and they can occur throughout the life cycle of groundwater pump and treat operations. Optimization reviews can result in substantial cost avoidance and savings, and they can also reduce the time to completion. Opportunities to increase the ability to influence remediation costs include improving operations, modifying the remedy, or streamlining of remedy progress monitoring. And finally, performance-based pump and treat optimization uses data to maintain the effectiveness and efficiency of the remedy. And with that, I'll transition to Pat Lachlan, and she'll present section 3 of the training.
All right, thank you, Luke. So this section addresses the performance evaluation of an existing pump and treat system. The results of the evaluation are utilized at the stage of the system optimization in section 4. So here's how the performance evaluation fits within the life cycle of a pump and treat project. One thing that needs to be emphasized is that the performance evaluation may need to be conducted several times and at different stages. For example, before the optimization stage to provide data for the optimization, and after the optimization to establish how it affected the system performance. We will talk about triggers, objectives, and the process of doing a performance evaluation. All right, so this figure was covered extensively in the last section, but it does show the components that could trigger a performance evaluation. All the components may be subject to performance evaluation at some point in the process. The subject of this module is the evaluation of the performance of an existing pump and treat system. So the discussion focuses on the systems that have been operating for some time. The initial design isn't addressed. And treatment system assessments are discussed in other documents, and some are listed in section 3 of our document. The main points of the module are: why would the performance evaluation be conducted? What are the objectives of doing it? And how is the process conducted? So our key takeaways for this section: the performance evaluation is an iterative process and should be conducted when needed at different points in the project life cycle, in conjunction with other life cycle events. An example is to evaluate system performance before and after the optimization process. The performance evaluations should be part of the general operation of the system and project milestones, such as completion of the source remediation. It can also be triggered by significant external events, such as natural disasters. Resiliency and sustainability should be included in the evaluation process, you know, assessing the performance under power outage or assessing the energy usage. It's important to point out that conducting the evaluation doesn't necessarily imply that changes need to be made. The result may indicate that the pump and treat system is still the most advantageous option as to be opposed to using other remediation technologies. There are few opportunities for improvement of the existing system. The best course of action may be to continue with the system as is. And finally, when doing an evaluation, ask yourself if pump and treat is still the best option. So here is one of our poll questions. It's another knowledge check. What can trigger an evaluation of the pump and treat system? A remediation milestone, a major external event, new regulatory limits, lack of progress, stakeholder concerns, or all of the above? All right, I see that pretty much everyone got the right answer. All of the above can be valid reasons for initiating the process. Performance evaluation is an integral element of the remedy and should be conducted routinely. However, there are specific triggers that require that more than routine evaluation efforts are in order. For convenience, they may be divided into internal and external. So internal drivers are those that are directly related to the performance of the system. There can be a number of these drivers. Some examples are new information that substantially changed the understanding of the project. It may concern the hydrogeology, fate and transport. You could be asking yourself, does the CSM need to be updated? Is the current system still able to provide containment? Has a new contaminant been discovered? And if so, can the treatment system address the new constituent? Poor performance is another internal driver. This may be occurring if there's loss of capture or slow aquifer restoration, loss of capacity or efficiency of the extraction wells, inability to achieve the required treatment levels, or you could be having exceedances of the discharge limits following treatment. Some of the unexpected outcomes you might need to look out for include affecting any nearby wetlands by lowering the groundwater table. You could be redirecting the plume, or you could be affecting nearby water supply systems. External drivers are not directly related to the system performance. Instead, they're an effect of outside factors. There can be a number of these drivers, and some common external drivers are listed here. Budget issues, for example, are triggered by a change in the site ownership. Regulatory considerations are changes in the regulatory standards, such as inclusion of new contaminants of concern. A recent example is PFAS. More stringent discharge limits, different monitoring or reporting requirements, transition of agency leads, new land or water use. Stakeholder issues. In some cases, the stakeholders are the driving force for change. The stakeholders often have intimate connections with a specific site and are the first to notice changes through remedial efforts, such as the stream is the wrong color, the system is too loud, there are unusual odors. Stakeholder issues may come to the forefront as a result of changes to the makeup of the surrounding community, changes in ownership of neighbors. Sustainability and resiliency considerations may come to the forefront, especially for older systems that were not originally designed with that in mind. Issues like extreme weather, climate change, carbon footprint, water reuse, energy efficiency, the ability to function under adverse conditions, or new green remediation and resilience methods. There are two main objectives that we discuss why a performance evaluation would be required. What are the objectives of conducting it? Two main high-level objectives of the performance evaluation. The first is to assess whether the pump and treat system is fulfilling its goals. These are generally related to providing capture of the plume and achieving the treatment of the extracted groundwater in accordance with discharge limits. Sometimes there's also an objective of affecting contaminant of concern mass, either from the source or from the plume. The second project goal is to provide data for future use in process optimization or system transition and termination. Various performance evaluation activities may be related to one of these objectives or both. Now, I don't expect you to be able to read this figure. It's figure 3.3 in the main document. However, we will walk through this flowchart to discuss one example of a performance evaluation process. You should be reviewing your compliance data and looking for exceedances. Evaluate your external forces and the ability to isolate issues. Determine if the process functions as designed. Do you need to collect more data? Look at your system maintenance. See if you've been conducting everything in the appropriate schedule. Evaluate your individual process steps. Determine if your system is cost effective. Do you need optimization? Are there any other corrective actions needed, or is it time to transition away from pump and treat? So this is just one example of the process. Not every step is applicable to every site, and they need to be adjusted for your particular site needs. All right, another knowledge check. So what activity would not be directly related to the performance evaluation? Assessing whether your hydraulic capture is being maintained, assessing whether discharge limits are being achieved, obtaining the contaminant of concern mass removal history, acquire the historic contaminant of concern concentration data, assess the applicability of other remedial technologies. All right, so more than half of you did it right. Assessing the applicability of other remedial technologies is actually part of the optimization process and not the evaluation process. The first four are related to the two high-level objectives of the performance evaluation. And now we'll look at the case study and the triggers for their evaluation. So the triggers for the Baytown case, site were the rebounding TCE concentrations in the pump and treat system after an initial in-situ chemical oxidation source treatment. Those were done in 2011 and 2015. This is an internal driver related to poor performance. They had costly long-term monitoring of residential wells with varying concentrations. So here was an external driver, budget considerations. And they found data gaps in the source zone. The Vado zone was an ongoing source. This was another internal driver, new information about a possible additional source. So the objectives of their evaluation was to optimize pump and treat costs and energy requirements and decide if there is a more efficient approach. The process they used was using modeling. They did a capture zone analysis in 2010, after shutting down one well. And then they did a man-candle analysis to evaluate changes in the contaminant concentration at each well. There are many more case studies in Appendix B, each with a unique trigger and outcome. And modeling is discussed in Appendix C, which is common concepts. So back to our key takeaways. As seen with the case study, multiple iterations of evaluations were performed. They were triggered by groundwater conditions and costs. Performance evaluations should be conducted at regular intervals over the life of the project. Climate change and rising utility costs should be taken into consideration when doing evaluations. Don't be surprised to find that your system is already operating optimally. And keep an eye out for opportunities to transition away from simple pump and treat. And now we will break for our first question and answer session.
Thank you, Pat. Just get to the slide here. All right. So as Pat said, we're going to start our first live Q&A portion of the training. So I'm going to look to the Q&A pod and see if our attendees have any questions for our trainers. We will have another Q&A session at the end of the modules today. So we have two opportunities for questions. So I'll pause here and wait to see if we get any questions in the Q&A pod. I'll take this moment just to do a quick little plug for ITRC trainings. We have tons and tons of training opportunities archived on the CLUIN website. If you're interested in any additional topics or archive sessions, I can put that link in the chat for everybody. But we've got lots of great content on the CLUIN archive page. So if we don't have any questions for this first Q&A portion, we can move on with content and then just save some time for, oh, I spoke too soon. We got a question in. All right, trainers. So our first question, do you have a sense of how frequently the performance optimization process results in the conclusion that an alternate remedy is required?
Hi, this is Charles. I think it depends on your site conditions and the site itself. Depends on what your contaminants are. If you have contaminants that are trapped in finer grain materials and you're getting a lot of back diffusion, you may want to step out and perform additional remedial efforts just besides pump and treat. So it really depends on your site conditions. I hate to say that, but that's what it boils down to. But it's a really important to do really good site characterization so you really know what's going on at your site and you have a good, strong CSM.
Thank you, Charles. All right. It looks like, I spoke too soon. We got another question in the Q&A pod. How effective is pump and treat remediation technology in a clay soil?
Similar to Charles' response regarding fine-grained soils and selection of an alternative technology, I would say pump and treat technology is effective at removing impacted groundwater from permeable soils. And it can be used to mitigate some level of back diffusion, but to treat the actual clay soil itself, it's not going to be highly effective and will require quite some time because it's really limited by a diffusion limited transport out of that clay soil.
All right. Thank you, Luke. All right, with that, we will move on to our next section. Again, we will have another Q&A at the end, so feel free to pop your questions in the Q&A pod throughout the training, and we'll save those for that last live Q&A session. So with that, Charles is up next to talk about Section 4, Process Optimization.
Okay. There we go. All right. Oops, went too many far. There we go. All right, just got in a little. There we go. Sorry about that. Okay, I'm Charles Graff. I'm a geologist with the state of Michigan in our Superfund program. Section 4 addresses the optimization of existing pump and treat systems that are based on the evaluation that were performed in Section 3. You'll note in the upcoming slides, there are section references and parentheses. These will point you directly to that part of the document we are discussing during this presentation. Section 4 will discuss the likely recommendations to address issues that were identified in the performance evaluation. The optimization recommendations are meant to improve the performance, reliability, resilience, and effectiveness of the remedy. They should reduce the overall cost of the remedy, the time to achieve remedial objectives, and the environmental footprint. Basically, the point of the optimization is to make the remedy better, faster, cheaper, and greener. This is the heart of the document, the optimization, the transition from pump and treat to other technologies or to site closure will be discussed in the next section. Key takeaways, things we want you to remember. These bullets are essentially an overview of this section, how to improve the remedy optimization once we have done the evaluation. The two chapters are like peanut butter and jelly. They go together. It is not possible to perform an adequate optimization without first performing an appropriate system evaluation. Changes to the subsurface will be for extraction and injection systems, including preventative maintenance, the above ground treatment system modifications, which may include increased use of automation or incorporation of newer treatment technologies to improve the pump and treat remedy. Adjustments to the performance monitoring program for both the subsurface and above surface treatment system, which may include additional detailed site characterization to support remedy modifications. And lastly, the incorporation of or transition to other technologies to improve the remedy. The first optimization steps address the existing pump and treat system. This is a normal part of this process, along with continual evaluation. The changes recommended in an optimization process should be based on keeping an eye on the effectiveness of the pump and treat system, which naturally brings optimization potentials to light. These recommendations are necessary to adapt to site and system changes while gauging the progress of the cleanup. Often, the availability of new technologies and better practices were not available when the system was initially installed and should be of interest to make the system better, faster, or cheaper. For example, this is a photo of a packed air tower stripper that has been significantly upgraded. Optimization is not an admission of weakness or of any past decisions. Optimization is about an opportunity to improve the existing system It should not be viewed negatively. Evaluations can result in changes to the CSM. As site conditions change, so must the CSM, as well as the remedial approach. The CSM is basically telling you how the site works, and the CSM should be seen as an evergreen document. Some of the common recommendations may be to evaluating historical storage and disposal activities, then making recommendations to better treat the source area through additional site characterization, particularly high resolution or advanced characterization of the source area, since any remaining source material will continue to generate groundwater contamination and thereby extend the duration of the remedy. Optimizing the system due to changed site conditions like nearby pumping or land use changes or climate issues that can result in new groundwater flow directions or changes in the aquifer thickness. See the ITRC guidance on advanced site characterization for some great information. This brings us to our first poll question. Have you undertaken additional site characterization after the pump and treat remedy was constructed to update the CSM? Please click all that apply that you have dealt with. And we'll wait for the answers to roll in. Feel like we should have music here or something. Okay. Well, it looks like we've got quite a variety of answers. And this is kind of what we expected. This question is meant to show that this is not an uncommon situation. Note that additional site characterization may be conducted in areas that prove recalcitrant to meaningful concentration reductions. For example, potent source areas left behind that have never been addressed. This process will usually involve a renewed evaluation of data and system performance, like in Section 3, and development of new recommendations, Section 4. And thank you for your participation. There we go. An evaluation of the system may suggest a need to adjust the pumping and injection rates, if applicable, to address a lack of hydraulic and chemical capture, or a shrinking plume where less capture is needed. This evaluation of performance will hopefully have considered the EPA guidance on capture zone analysis, including performance of capture zone evaluation and/or conducting the modeling necessary to provide more lines of evidence for capture. Recommendations may also include those pumping changes just noted, or eliminating some extraction wells, replacing pumps with ones more appropriate providing complete capture, or adding new extraction and injection wells to better capture and remediate the plumes. These changes can greatly enhance the sustainability of the remedy by assuring energy use is only that required for the remedial goals and for maintaining complete capture, improving efficiency, and speeding up the cleanup. Modeling can assist in optimizing various aspects of the remedy, for example, using fate and transport models. Well fouling and maintenance issues require recommendations for improving well performance and monitoring, developing criteria for preventative well maintenance, and approved well construction for any new or replacement wells. What we're seeing in the photo here are tools for well development or rehabilitation. And I suggest we see our document for a better look at this photo and a description of these processes. Recommendations may also include assessing piping or conveyance issues, such as pressure drops as an indication of mineral scaling, added sediment buildup, biofouling, or poor design, and may require the replacement of encrusted sections of piping, adding cleanouts, adding inline booster pumps, or development of or changes to maintenance practices. They may also include replacement of piping with alternate sizes and materials, and a resilience check-in. Recommendations can and should also consider flooding potential, drought impacts such as declining water levels, and saltwater intrusion for potential coastal sites. See Section 6 of the document for more ideas. There we go. Now we'll discuss the optimization of existing above ground or treatment components. This slide is recommendations for the above ground system can be as simple as tweaks to the chemical dosages, carbon changeout decisions, or air water ratios for air strippers. It is helpful to focus on older equipment that may have lots of downtime or require more labor than newer alternatives. Recommendations may include modifications to or replacement of treatment components. For example, changing to a shallow tray air stripper versus using an older packed tower air stripper as flow rates or concentrations drop, or eliminating metals precipitation as concentration decrease at a site. Updates to motor controls, including variable frequency drives or newer SCADA systems and auto callout capability, improve uptime. The recommendations are to be proactive on maintenance rather than reactive. This is also can be read as preventative maintenance. This can make a large impact on uptime while reducing labor and repair costs. Optimization of the performance monitoring program is also important. Oftentimes, the original site wells were installed for delineation purposes, not for performance evaluation. And as a result, the monitoring program should be optimized. The optimization process considers the current monitoring program, both subsurface and the treatment process above ground, and can assure that no more or no less data are collected than necessary for making site decisions. The recommendations require a basis in the conceptual site model, including groundwater flow, plume extent and distribution, and possible exposure locations developed during the performance evaluation. The understanding of groundwater flow should incorporate the three-dimensional flow between water-bearing units under pumping and injection conditions. It also requires an understanding of the treatment processes and information necessary to efficiently operate the treatment system to meet the treatment goals. Sampling and sampling recommendations usually address the frequency of sampling, the location of sampling points, and the methods used for sampling or field measurements during sampling, including various chemical and physical parameters, for example, dissolved oxygen, pH, oxidation reduction potential, your basic groundwater stabilization parameters. And this is the photograph we're seeing here is a gentleman who has switched from one type of sampling, has gone to passive sampling at a site in southwestern United States. Analysis may recommend consideration of alternative analytical methods or a limited analyte list for chemicals, either to obtain more precise data, to address additional or emerging contaminants, or to reduce costs. See Appendix A in the document that provides information on a host of computer tools that can help with these activities. Such tools still need the oversight of experienced professionals to address stakeholder concerns anticipated changes in land use or climate, or simply idiosyncrasies of well construction. In addition, monitoring changes likely require coordination with regulatory agencies. The time required to modify a permit must be considered in the optimization schedule. As many of you probably realize, some permits can be modified quickly. Others may take many months. See Section 7 of the document for more detail. Process optimization is another form of optimization. And this slide recommends adding enhancements to an existing pump and treat system to improve efficiency. And what we're seeing here in the photograph is bioaugmentation for hotspot treatment at a former defense site in the upper Midwest of the United States. These recommendations are made to integrate other remedial actions into a pump and treat remedy, such as in situ treatments. The recommendation may also include the use of pumping and injection wells to create circulation cells for the delivery of remedial amendments, for example, chemical oxidants or carbon sources, to improve the rate of remediation and distribution of amendments where surface features constrain or deep contaminants limit the effectiveness of a simple injection. Recommendations can also be made for transitioning from pump and treat to M&A, especially at the edges of a plume, or other technologies that offer distinct advantages in cleanup speed and or cost, but this will be discussed shortly in Section 5. Short-term interim measures or any combination of complementary remedial measures may be implemented to improve the remedy. Pump and treat can also be recommended in the remedy selection phase as an interim remedy to remove contaminant mass, stabilize the plume, or provide containment of the plume to prevent uncontrolled migration as an interim action pending development of a more holistic remedy. The cost for implementing the recommendations made during the optimization need to be estimated. This allows for an informed decision on implementing the action or not, especially where recommendations have been made for actions with varying levels of complexity that are subject to uncertainty, basically the cost-benefit analysis. Those responsible for the decision can identify the best use of possibly limited funds they may have for remedial improvement. There is inherent uncertainty in the estimated cost impacts regarding changes that can or may shorten the often very long remediation times for pump and treat alone. It may be prudent to perform some computer modeling to assess the possible or probable reduction in duration. These models will have uncertainties in input parameters and discretization. The uncertainties of estimating time and costs are much larger if modeling is not done. Estimated cost can be compared to the capital outlay for continued pump and treat to see which is cheaper. The optimization report should either document the site background, current and or baseline conditions, remedial costs and objectives, or should reference documents with that available information. The focus should be the findings and recommendations, including associated cost impacts, if possible. We have a second poll question. This is basically a scenario. The purpose, we have a pump and treat system. It's been in operation since 92, has an airstripping treatment, has high labor and maintenance costs, and this volatile organic plume that has been reduced by 50% in footprint and 70% in concentration. And basically, just click all that you would think that would apply to this. That's a really even split. And this is the purpose of this question is to reinforce the concepts just covered. The video or the picture we're seeing here is an airstripper in Arizona that's been undergone extensive automation. Thank you for your responses. Here we are again at the Baytown case study. This is this slide will illustrate summarizes the optimization recommendation from the 2011 optimization report that's been alluded to in the past for the case study. The recommendations focused on the source area treatment, including additional source area characterization and treatment under and around the buildings, evaluating in situ chemical oxidation using a performance-based contract approach, and evaluating in situ bioremediation as an alternative or a contingent technology to ISCO, implementing a tracer study to assess flow paths for injected amendments, and performing detailed modeling for the potential for an M&A remedy, including consideration of abiotic transformation. By the way, this site kicked off the assessment of iron minerals as agents of degradation for chlorinated compounds. Recommendations included conducting a formal capture zone evaluation per EPA protocols, implementing changes to the monitoring program, including passive sampling and chemical trend analysis of nearby private wells. There we go. Again, these are recommendations from an actual optimization study and are good examples of the common output from such an evaluation. Some of the recommendations are reduce blower flow rates on the airstripper, evaluate point of use carbon systems for efficiency, reconsider design of the motors for the extraction wells, diagnose and address causes of the infiltration system scaling, implement routine regular inspections of the equipment, especially the electrical system, relocating filtration steps in the process, and improving data management by preparing annual reports. Key takeaways. Here again are key takeaways we want you to recall. Modifications of the treatment system and the monitoring program are some of the first things that we do for optimization. Recommendations may include any of these choices. Modification to the extraction injection system, including preventative maintenance. Additional detailed site characterization to support changes to the remedy. Cost impact should be assessed and explained. And transitioning to or incorporating other technologies to improve the remedy itself. And setting the stage for transitioning from pump and treat, which will be discussed next. Now I'd like to turn this over to our next speaker, Mr. Bruce Kennington.
Thank you, David. This next section, we'll talk about transition and termination of a pump and treat system. This section provides decision to support to help transition out of pump and treat into another remedial option that is more effective at achieving the remedial objectives. It assumes that a performance evaluation has already been completed, as discussed earlier in this presentation of Section 3 of the guidance document, and that the pump and treat system has already been optimized, as discussed just in the preceding section for Section 4 on pump and treat optimization. Further, overall, it's been determined that there's no further need for the pump and treat system. and that the pump and treat system will not achieve the remedial objectives. So far, we've provided an overview of the basis of a pump and treat design and implementation, how to perform an evaluation and then optimize a pump and treat system. In this section, we present a stepwise process for transitioning from pump and treat to another remedial technology, or considerations for terminating the pump and treat system altogether, particularly if it's reached the end of its useful life or usefulness. Following presentation of this step-by-step process, we'll illustrate some of these transition principles in a case study. Again, this section applies to the end of life stage for a pump and treat system. As you can see in the optimization life cycle diagram to the right, we're at the tail end of the life of a pump and treat system. A typical project at this point in the life cycle will, as I said, already have optimized the pump and treat system, and you may have gone through multiple iterations of that. It could involve a deficient pump and treat system with failing performance evaluation, and or there may have been alternate remedial technologies that are more efficient to replace the pump and treat system. Key takeaways. Ultimately, all pump and treat systems will either meet their remedial objectives or transition off pump and treat to an alternate technology such as M&A, in situ treatment, or engineering institutional land use controls, for example. One of the most here we have for this section key takeaways, identification of key indicators. This involves determining when enough is enough and justification to make a change. We'll also talk about transition plan and the value thereof. Transition plan in this particular case specifies one or more criteria that when triggered will signify the need and start of a transition out of pump and treat into a remedy that is more effective and efficient. We'll also present a step-by-step process that will be used to develop the rationale for the transition, implementation of the transition, and decommission of a pump and treat system while engaging stakeholders all the way on this journey. It is recognized that there are site-specific and variable ways that transitions can occur. Not all sites are the same. And you'll see this as a recurring theme throughout this guidance document, but certainly in this section, which is engagement of stakeholders in the transition process to improve the chances of success of the transition. Here we have a poll question, similar to other sections. We pause to present a question, in this case regarding transition. This is not really a knowledge check, but rather we look to gauge the experience of the participants in this training. Please select an answer that best matches your experience in general with pump and treat system transitions. Please note in this case, there is no correct answer. So please go ahead and we'll wait a few moments for people to enter their response. And here we have the response of everyone. And not surprising, we see the experience of people in terms of transitioning out of pump and treat systems is pretty wide ranging. It's one of the reasons why we look to develop this guidance document. In section five, as mentioned in section five of the guidance document, we present a streamlined step-by-step approach to planning for transition and termination of a pump and treat system. Often there is resistance or can be reluctance to change, and having a plan can help make improve the chances or improve the success of making that transition. Such planning enables introduction of innovative approaches that may not have been previously existed. The concept of transitioning off pump and treat into a more cost-effective remedy follows commonly accepted management principles, such as adaptive site management. Having a solid plan avoids inefficiencies and potential excuse me, potentially costly do-overs. In an ideal situation, there's a short lag time between discovery and initiation of implementation of a pump and treat transition. Typically, this does not occur. An implementation of pump and treat transition can be delayed, significantly delayed, resulting in additional costs with scant to no tangible benefit. Again, a well-illustrated transition, ultimately a termination plan, provides an opportunity for continued stakeholder engagement and increased community awareness. So it's important to engage stakeholders early and often in this process. Transition planning. Section 5 of the guidance documents deals with transition planning. Please note that this guidance document only addresses transition from pump and treat to another remedial technology and does not necessarily apply to all potential remedial transition. A transition plan should specify one or more criteria that could be conditions or triggers that, when met, will signify the need or start of transition out of pump and treat to a remedy that is more effective and efficient. Such criteria and triggers might include a decline in contaminant concentrations, or mass removal becomes diminishing returns or asymptotic, exceedance of a cost threshold or other environmental footprint as measured by greenhouse gas emissions per mass removed is another example. Identification of an alternate technology that can achieve contaminant reduction more efficiently and effectively. also, certainly, a change in the remedial action objectives such that a pump and treat system is no longer necessary. There are other documents that describe how to close out a site or transition when cleanup objectives have been achieved. This is particularly important due to the inexperience of, or can be due to the inexperience of the project team and or regulators. For more information on completing cleanup upon achieving objectives, see other exit strategy related documents available from the ITRC. Transition and termination steps. We'll talk about the step-by-step process. Step one, the transition begins with step one, trigger conditions. What conditions may have been reached? How do you determine when enough is enough? Step two is development of lines of evidence to support a transition and to develop alternative remedial approaches beyond what pump and treat alone may be unable to achieve. In many cases, this involves revisiting and updating the CSM for a site, assessing plume behavior, and identifying alternate remedial technologies. The last step in the transition process is presented in step three. Step three involves implementing the transition. This could involve securing operation of a pump and treat system or implementing a phase transition that includes alternate technologies. Please note that this is an idealized logical process summary of a transition process. Because remediation can be implemented in different ways at your site and due to a multitude of site-specific factors, the actual sequence of activities determined in each step can vary. Step one, trigger conditions. Let's look at each of these steps in some more detail. As a reminder, there's quite a bit of information on discussion of the step-by-step process in section 5.3 of the guidance document. Step one is a screening process, essentially intended to answer the question, is pump and treat the wrong remedial solution to achieve the remedial objectives? It starts with indicators already presented during the earlier stages of optimization. You're asking yourself the following questions. Are there limitations in meeting remedy objectives? Are there economic resource factors? Are there more effective and efficient alternatives? Are there energy use and waste generation considerations that outweigh the value of continued pump and treat? The result of step one is a consensus from the project team, including regulators and stakeholders, on the remedy deficiency and the need for a transition off pump and treat. With respect to sustainable resilient remediation, there certainly are SRR considerations. For example, at many pump and treat sites, the consumption of non-renewable resources and waste generation may far outweigh the value of continued pump and treat and forms one key trigger for the transition and termination of pump and treat. Along those lines, shown here is figure 5.2 from section 5 of the guidance document, just showing an indicator in this particular case where the cost, in this particular case, greenhouse gas emissions, exceed the benefit, which is mass removal. And that may signal or herald the need for change. Step two is identifying the transition approach in developing the lines of evidence to support pump and treat transition. After the need for transition is determined, you know, in step one, it's time to develop a detailed rationale used to support, the transition. Step two is a detailed evaluation process, essentially intended to answer the question, if pump and treat is the wrong remedial solution, then what alternatives are more effective or efficient to achieve the remedial objectives and why? It is important to revise the site conceptual model, the CSM, as part of the step in the transition process to update it with new data collected during pump and treat operations and supplemented as necessary. You know, very typically in long-term operation of a pump and treat system, substantial amount of data and information can be collected on the performance of the remedy and what's actually going on that may far outweigh what was known when pump and treat was selected as a remedy to begin with. And so it's imperative and very fundamentally important to update a conceptual site model. Please note that selection of an alternate remedy is outside the subject matter of this guidance document. There are other ITRC documents on this particular subject. There also may be project-specific protocols that may be required. Here's an example. This is a table from Section 5 of the guidance document showing example lines of evidence, and some of them supporting transition, others, just talking about how the remedy is performing altogether. Everything that's potentially examples here as shown are, what's the trend in contaminant concentrations? What's happening there? The plume behavior and how things are decreasing or changing over time. Certainly the overall pump and treat design and performance and cost factors with operating a pump and treat system. Other transition scenarios addressed in the guidance document include sites where contaminant mass discharge is greater than the assimilative attenuation capacity of an aquifer, where attenuation mechanisms are not evident, resulting in unreasonable timeframes, and sites where pump and treat will have difficulty in cost effectively meeting remediation objectives. Section 5.5 of the guidance document covers step three. After the pump and treat transition approach is selected and lines of evidence to support the transition are assembled, a means to communicate its implementation is a controlling document such as a work plan. Implementation of the pump and treat transition can take various forms depending upon your regulatory program and the remedial strategy for a particular site. Pump and treat transition can be implemented in essentially three main ways. Hard stop, a phased transition, or simultaneous transition using an alternate remedial alternative, for example. All these options involve ultimately the shutdown of the pump and treat system. Of importance in transition, as discussed from the very beginning, is stakeholder engagement. The involvement of regulators and stakeholders is critical to getting the transition right. Regulatory program and stakeholder considerations often drive how a transition is implemented and the success thereof. System termination. As previously mentioned, system termination can occur after the pump and treat system was optimized. That's discussed in Section 4, the previous section. It can also occur as a last logical step in the process of transitioning off pump and treat after its beneficial use life cycle. For example, administrative actions are subject to regulatory framework would include the regulatory stakeholder agreements previously made as part of the remediation strategy and documented in a controlling document developed as part of the pump and treat operation. The agreement may also include details on the fate of the pump and treat system, equipment, and wells. Once the administrative actions are completed and the necessary approvals are obtained, the physical actions to terminate the pump and treat system may commence. Depending on the agreed fate of the equipment and wells, the physical actions can range from mothballing and deactivating the system, placing it in a standby mode so it can be restarted if needed, or complete system deconstruction and well abandonment. It's very important that the pump and treat system termination is collectively determined and agreed upon by the project team, regulators, and stakeholders. Next, we'll revisit Baytown. As you may recall, Baytown is a Superfund site in Minnesota. We'll talk about the case study, or Baytown as a case study. This is included, a lot more information included in Appendix B to the guidance document. We'll talk about this particular case study where they did a transition evaluation. They went through the three-step process that we presented here, and then they successfully transitioned from pump and treat to M&A. Overall, for this particular case, it was a five-year process. In the case of Baytown, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency installed and operated pump and treat system beginning as early as 2008 as a hydraulic containment barrier. Over the next 6 years, they conducted additional source area delineation. The first thing that they did identified a trigger. The pump and treat system, they initiated a pump and treat system shutdown, and they did a source area transition evaluation, including two phases of in situ remediation, one using in situ chemical oxidation, and the second phase using enhanced reductive dechlorination. In this particular case at Baytown, because of the byproducts of the in situ process, and they were doing this beneath a building, they had to put in a vapor mitigation system just to protect vapor intrusion getting into the building from off-gassing from the process. In this particular case, the ISCO results showed significant rebound, but the ERD treatment results, although they varied across the source area, they generally showed further reduction in TCE concentrations, more so than what they were experiencing with pump and treat. Next, they implemented step two. You know, due to implementing diminishing returns, the pump and treat system contaminant source zone. Due to diminishing returns of the pump and treat system, contaminant source zone depletion following source area treatment and supporting lines of evidence, the more sustainable and cost-effective remedial action was selected to transition from pump and treat system to M&A. Further to this, and to support this decision, regulatory approval was obtained to perform a short-term shutdown evaluation. The results show that there was no significant rebound during the shutdown evaluation, and regulatory approval was received for a longer-term shutdown. Step three, in 2021, as part of step three in the transition to M&A and termination of the pump and treat system, they implemented this transition plan. As part of this transition, a shutdown and monitoring plan was prepared. The plan described the changes made to the system for long-term shutdown and the requirements for a restart of the system in the future if it was so determined. The takeaway from this all is that transition to more sustainable, cost-effective remedial actions can take different forms. The stepwise approach that we presented here and also included in Section 5 of the guidance document is intended to show the process should be flexible and adaptable to site conditions. Note, there are several case studies also included in Appendix B of the guidance document that illustrate one or more of the transition and termination steps that we presented here, and it's encouraged for you to review those case studies. Let's revisit our key takeaways that we presented at the beginning. In this section, we provided a few guidelines and steps on how to transition from pump and treat system to more sustainable, cost-effective, active and passive remedial action, such as in the case of the Baytown site in Minnesota. We spent time looking at several key indicators for successful termination. We reviewed the value of a transition plan. We discussed the step-by-step process. Looked at several site-specific and variable ways transition and pump and treat can occur. And lastly, but not least, is we discussed and stressed the importance of, stakeholder engagement, but also the importance of sustainability and resiliency during stakeholder and resiliency as part of the process. With that, I will transition over to Michael.
All right. Thanks, Bruce, for that overview on Section 5. We've covered a lot of material today with our trainers, so let's do a quick recap. Luke's walked us through the life cycle optimization framework, which is covered in Section 2 of the guidance. Pat covered the performance evaluation concepts of Section 3 of the guidance document. Charles talked about process optimization and management for evolving site conditions. It's outlined in Section 4. And we just heard from Bruce about system transition and termination. So do you remember our training learning objectives from the start of the class? Optimization can and should occur throughout the life cycle of the pump and treat system. We've presented a systematic process for performance evaluation, process optimization, and system transition. This process can and should occur throughout the active life of the pump and treat system, regardless of the regulatory framework. Pump and treat optimization can be beneficial to all parties involved. Optimization can lead to faster, more efficient, timely, and effective cleanup. These efforts benefit the environment, the public, stakeholders, regulators, and the companies involved. Recommendations to optimize a pump and treat system are based on an iterative performance evaluation process. As the system is optimized, additional data is generated, evaluated, and recommendations made as to whether further optimization is necessary. Ultimately, the pump and treat will either meet the remediation objectives or will need to transition. Optimization will improve an existing pump and treat system but can't fix everything. The performance evaluation may demonstrate that the system cannot achieve the objectives alone or possibly at all. The decision may be to pair the pump and treat system with another remedy or even replace it entirely. And optimization is not performed in a vacuum. There are numerous parties that need to be involved in the optimization decision implementation, such as stakeholders, regulators, and the companies that are regulated. The regulatory framework and sustainable resilient remediation options also need to be considered. The pump and treat document is available on the ITRC website, itrcweb.org, under the guidance documents. After the training, the document can be utilized as a resource for additional information in a pick-your-own-adventure fashion to focus on just what you need at the time. So let's turn it over to Devin for questions at this time.
Thanks so much, Michael. All right, so we're going to jump right into our last Q&A session of the training today. I'll look to the Q&A pod at this time for any questions for our trainers. So first up, are you aware of any pump and treat systems that have been shut down based on greenhouse gas cost / benefit analysis?
I'm not aware of any. This is Charles. I'm not aware of any.
All right. Thank you, Charles. All right. Unless any of our other trainers have anything to add to that specific question, I'll move on. All right. How do or should shutdown tests play a role to optimization of pump and treat systems?
I can start answering that question. If a team is considering shutting down a system, either in a phased fashion or all at once, if it was a smaller system, let's say, a shutdown test is really necessary, and it's really part of evaluating whether the concentration trends that you're seeing are a result of continued operation of the system or a true reduction in risk or a reduction in contaminant mass. All the optimization work that I've been involved with pump and treat systems, shutdown tests were really a requirement of the overall approach. And the shutdown test may become a permanent shutdown as well.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And it's also helpful because if you're not sure exactly what's happening with your source material, perhaps, as Luke and I mentioned earlier, if you have finer grain materials where contaminants are basically trapped, and they're bleeding off very slowly, or is often referred to as back diffusion. You won't know that necessarily until you shut off your system. And then you can actually observe rebound in certain wells, and then you can figure out what's really going on. Some cases you just have a very permeable aquifer and you don't get much rebound, but sometimes, quite often, at least here in Michigan, we have a lot of fine grain materials mixed in with more permeable materials, and that's where the contaminants hang up for long periods of time. So it's important to have your perform the shutdown. Plays an important role.
Thank you, Charles and Luke. Keeping in the theme of shutdowns, after a shutdown evaluation, how many years should pass before dismantling the pump and treat system? Is there a good rule of thumb?
I hate to say this, but it's going to be site specific. Depends on how large the site is, what your contaminants are. If you're considering just leaving your system shut down, you should probably have a very good handle on the degradation rates of any contaminants that you have. So if you're not familiar with that and you don't have a good site characterization, you may want to just keep that system mothballed until you get it figured out what's really going on with the contaminants apart from the pump and treat system. So I would have to say there's probably not a good rule of thumb. That's my two cents. I could be wrong.
And I'll add just a little bit to it in the fact that depending on the regulatory program you're working in, there may be set requirements as to how long you need to go without having standard exceedances before you would end the termination or terminate the remediations itself. And so that will play in some to your consideration of when you would want to consider dismantling is when that actual termination of the system would, or the remediation would occur too from the regulatory standard.
Yeah, I can add a little bit to that actually. So we did have a site in Massachusetts where we did perform a shutdown. EPA had actually done an optimization and had made a recommendation for shutdown. And we had certain criteria that we use to measure rebound. If we exceeded the criteria, certain areas of the site, we would have to restart the system. So after we shut down, we performed quite a bit of monitoring. We did some monthly monitoring and then quarterly monitoring, and we did not rebound to hit those criteria. And after 3 years, EPA approved the completely shut down and dismantling of the facility. So that was it was a Superfund site, so it was regulated by EPA. And that, so the state worked out with EPA the process and procedures to follow to do that exercise.
All right. Thanks, Janet, Michael, and Charles. Luke, did you have anything to add to that one? I see you're off mute.
I would just say sometimes it's a business decision as well. And, you know, an evaluation of, as Charles mentioned, risk of rebound, for example, and having a very good understanding of the conceptual site model, and also the need to use that portion of the site in the future as well.
All right. Thanks, Luke. All right. Next question. What should you do about an observed rebound in recovery wells after a 3-year shutdown at a site where the monitoring network and review of the CSM determined they were insufficient to monitor the site as it was originally assessed?
This situation does occur. And this relates back to the understanding of the conceptual site model. In many remedial optimization reviews, one of the common outcomes is that the conceptual site model needs some strengthening. So this might be one of those cases. And in this situation, perhaps there's another source area that might have been missed, or some entrained mass and maybe low permeability soils that may not have been adequately characterized. So that could be the reason for this. And what to do about this? Well, again, it probably depends on the nature of that rebound. Is it a substantial rebound? Is it maybe a more mild rebound? And also gathering more information as part of your CSM or conceptual site model enhancement might lead you down a direction of either perhaps a focused restart of the pump and treat system or an alternative technology to deal with the issue.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. There are times when a pump and treat system was installed because that was like the remedy that was popular at the time, and it performed adequately for a while. But it sounds in a situation like this, I'm just going to go on a limb, that perhaps the site was not as well characterized as it could have been. And that's where, like in section four, we were talking about going back to the site and doing some high resolution site characterization. It sounds like something like that would be important for a site like that that was just brought up. So, and there's plenty of sites that we see that are not well characterized before they put in a treatment system. So this would not be an isolated incident.
All right. Thank you, Charles and Luke. Next question. Do you have any recommendations for extraction or reinjection for well distilling and or reconditioning?
If it's silting from injection wells, typically there's a number of ways to get that out of there, but it sounds like we have a couple of things going on here. If it's just silt, it's not a big deal. Get a drill rig out there with somebody who knows what they're doing to rehab your wells. Rehab for both of these with regard to silting is going to be very similar. Probably go out there with a good surge block. Those two devices that was in one of the photographs that I had in there, those were surge blocks. And you just worked the formation really well. And those surge blocks actually had air devices that you could attach to the top. They had what's called a J-tube. So you put air down inside there. It draws everything that's removed out of the well and takes it immediately out of the well. So that'll pull all your silt and any sediment that may be inside your well and get a good portion of the area outside the well screen and the gravel pack cleaned out. So with a little bit of information, that's what I would do.
And then if it's an issue of biological fouling or mineral scaling, there's a number of commercially available chemical reagents that can be used to clean well screens, recondition those wells also. So that's another technique that's out there as well.
All right. Thank you, Luke and Charles, again. Next question. Is there a general rule of thumb for the frequency of well efficiency tests to be evaluated to help ensure extraction wells are operating at peak performance?
When you initially put in an extraction well, you should be measuring the efficiency of the well. That's called measuring your specific capacity. And when you first put the well in, that's the most efficient that the well is going to be. And you keep an eye on that measurement. Also, you can measure electrical consumption, water levels, all that. And so there's not a real rule of thumb, but basically you keep an eye on the efficiency of the wells. And when it starts to tail off, you need to evaluate why. As Luke just mentioned, you could have biofouling, you could have mineral incrustation, mineral scaling, And if the slot size of this green is too large, you could have sediment intrusion. You could have a lot of different things going on, but that's the importance of the evaluation. You need to find out what's going on. Once you figure that out, then you can do some rehabilitation on your well and bring it back up to close to its previous performance. I had a site where we had probably a dozen extraction wells, and we just made it up ourselves. Basically, once you lose 20% of your specific capacity, you need to get out there and do some preventative maintenance. And if things got really bad, then we went out there and did a major rehabilitation with blended chemical heat treatment, a lot of surging, just basically work the wells over for a couple of days. So just depends on what you're looking at.
There's an addition I'd like to make. If that should occur, and this is Trevor King with the team, one should also consider the pump and the conveyance lines, because oftentimes it could be the pump is fouling and not necessarily the well itself. That's a very expensive endeavor to go in and to bring a rig out and to redevelop the well if it's the pump and the lines that are plugged. So you need to evaluate the entire system holistically as you're making these decisions.
Trevor, you're a savior. Good point.
All right, thank you, trainers. Next question. Does the ITRC document have any guidance on statistics that could be used to help determine plume stability during a pump and treat shutdown?
Hi, this is Pat, and the quick answer to that is yes. Section 5, I believe, discusses things about plume stability during shutdowns, and I believe it can be found in the Common Concepts appendix. They talk a lot about the modeling and statistics and such in that appendix.
This also requires a really good monitoring program, a monitor well network, so that you have a really good handle on the depth and the distribution of your plume so you can observe changes through time. So if you don't have a good monitor well network, it's going to be very difficult to get a handle on that.
All right. Thank you, trainers. So that concludes our second Q&A portion of the training today. And so with that, I'm just going to wrap up the training here and then wish you all a great rest of your day. So I would like to take a moment to thank our expert trainers for being here, not only to take the time to develop this course, but for being here to support for the live training today. I'd also like to extend a thank you to all of our attendees for joining us. If you would like a certificate of completion, they are available on the Clumen training page, and that would be the first link I put in the chat here. The second is the specific online guidance document for our pump and treat document, if you would like to take a look at any of the referenced materials that was mentioned today. If you would like any further clarification on any answers provided or have any additional questions you would like to ask, feel free to email us at itrc@itrcweb.org. It's the name of my little screen here. We will work to get your questions answered, and we'll work with our trainers to make sure that they all get responded to. So with that, I will just again say thank you very much for joining us today. And hopefully we will see you again on a future ITRC webinar. Thank you, trainers.